Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we'll hear from a reserve in Sri Lanka, where they're locking the elephants out and the humans in.
The elephant is not an artifact, it's a living symbol, a living icon that represents many things that are very, very important to us as Sri Lankans. The national park boundary only makes sense to people. It's not an ecological boundary for any other animal in the park.
We'll also chat with a researcher about a new paper on predicting ocean circulation and what it means for climate.
Since this is the first study of AMOC prediction, we consider results encouraging.
Also, fairer wine from South Africa and fairer pineapples from Costa Rica.
How do you expect somebody to participate in farm management if he's living on a shack? How do you expect somebody to be owner of a farm or partly owner of a farm if you can't read and write, doesn't know what kind of contract he's signing?
Those stories later. I'm Nathan Witkop. Welcome to the show. We begin today in Sri Lanka. For the past 2 years, the South Asian country off the tip of India has been trying to recover from nearly three decades of civil war. Though the insurgency that divided Sri Lankans is over, another conflict remains. It's one that's been quietly killing for decades, a war for land that has pitted humans against elephants. Some in Sri Lanka are working to defuse this struggle, and they're rethinking conservation along the way. Instead of locking nature into reserves, they're locking the humans in. Yasmin Qureshi has the story.
At the Pinawala Elephant Orphanage in Sri Lanka, about 80 elephants graze and play in the morning sun. Nearby, a group of tourists from across Sri Lanka and around the world look on in awe. These towering creatures live in Pinawala because of what conservationists call human-elephant conflict. It's one of the biggest threats to the endangered Asian elephant.
Basically, people have encroached onto elephant habitat.
Ravi Koria is the president of the Sri Lanka Wildlife Conservation Society. He says every year roughly 220 elephants are killed out of a population of just 5,000. These 5'10 animals need a lot of space, about 5 square kilometers each, and they compete for land with Sri Lanka's growing population. Farmers trying to protect their crops sometimes kill the elephants, who can trample a cultivated field and destroy a farmer's livelihood in a matter of minutes.
So this creates incredible antagonism towards the elephant. Most farmers live in a sort of a eternal dead cycle. You know, they borrow to cultivate, then that harvest comes, they pay off their debt, keep some for their consumption, sell some to buy, you know, essential goods, and then next season comes, it's the same thing. So, but if elephant comes and destroys the crop, then it completely throws the whole cycle out of whack.
Koria says in some cases, the loss of elephant habitat causes these usually gentle animals to become aggressive. They've injured and even killed people they view as a threat. Waskamua in central Sri Lanka is home to a national park that was created as a wilderness refuge. The rolling hills and arid land makes the area ideal for elephants, but they are unwelcome neighbors for the local farmers. In the small village of Randonaveva, Angie Magdalene Nona tells the story of her terrifying encounter with an elephant.
We were sleeping in the house around midnight, and from over there, on the other side, the elephant came and broke the wall.
The elephant tore through the side of her mud house. Angie was rescued by her fellow villagers, and although she survived, she lost everything.
I am angry at the elephants. They destroyed the coconut trees. They vandalized my home, they ate all the rice, they broke all the furniture in the house, they destroyed everything.
Her family had to borrow 600,000 rupees, roughly 4,000 euros, to repair the damage. a debt that Angie says ultimately drove her husband to abandon the family. At another village just 20 minutes away, farmers still remember the days when elephants used to destroy their crops.
In those days, people were angry at elephants. We considered the elephant an enemy. That's the way we looked at it. Back then, elephants died. People would shoot and do other things to harm them.
But today, Atula Kumara doesn't worry about the elephants. The Sri Lanka Wildlife Conservation Society has created an elephant sanctuary in Waskamua, where elephants and humans coexist peacefully. Here, instead of fencing in the elephants, they've fenced in the villages. This village of Wahara Gulagama is protected by a solar-powered electric barrier that Ravi Koria designed.
The national park boundary only makes sense to people. It's not an ecological boundary for any other animal in the park. Our project is an example of a specific situation. There's no, silver bullet that's going to fix human-elephant conflict.
Atula Kumara says the fence has changed his life.
After the fence was put up, most of these problems were resolved, and now elephants rarely come by the village. The elephants stopped breaking houses, and harm to crops also declined drastically. Before the fence went up, people were killed by elephants. 6 people were killed in our village.
According to Koria, the village has doubled its farm produce, and income has increased threefold. Another benefit? Wild elephants roam the area freely. Devika Wirakun is a professor in the Department of Zoology at the University of Colombo. He says finding solutions comes down to land management.
We have about 600 kilometers of fences in this country. Some of them are in the middle of the forest because it happens to be the boundary between the forest department and the wildlife department. And you have elephants on both sides of the fence, which is a ridiculous situation. Now, these kinds of fences are useless. So any management technique, if not done properly, is not going to give you the dividends.
Wirakun has been working to soothe tensions between humans and elephants for years. He says one of the biggest obstacles is government apathy.
We are only scientists. We can only do research and come up with recommendations. But the right to implement them lies with government line agencies. So we've been talking to them, but I think it is partly our failure. For some reason, we have not been able to push them to do or try out some of the new things we are proposing.
Although there are signs of hope, Sri Lanka has lost 3/4 of the elephant population over the last century. As the nation struggles to recover from a civil war that raged for almost 3 decades, the government's top priorities are developing infrastructure and tourism. While he has no problem with this, Ravi Koria says he hopes Sri Lankans also remember the important role elephants have always played here.
The elephant is not an artifact. It's a living symbol, a living icon that represents many things that are very, very important to us as Sri Lankans. It's naive on our part to think of development and leave the elephant outside of it, or consider the elephant some kind of obstacle, a challenge for us to develop. That is, for me, does not make sense.
If anything, Koria says elephants are, and should remain, one of the country's most important assets. For Deutsche Welle Radio, I'm Yasmin Qureshi with Lily Jamali in Waskamua, Sri Lanka.
You're listening to Living Planet, a weekly show all about the environment, coming to you from Bonn in Germany. If you're looking for more of our content, come check out the webpage. That's dwworld.de/environment.
You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
The Hollywood movie The Day After Tomorrow depicted a world where melting Arctic ice cooled ocean currents, slowing them down and ushering in a rapid ice age in Europe and North America. Well, the movie was highly dramatized. There is a lot of genuine scientific interest in just how much ocean circulation affects climate. This week in Science magazine, a team of researchers in Hamburg published a study saying they think they've made a big step forward in efforts to predict ocean circulation. I spoke to lead author Daniela Matai at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, and I began by asking her how ocean circulation affects climate.
So we know that northwestern European climate has a much milder climate compared to other parts of the world that are located at the same latitude. And this is due to the very positive effect of the North Atlantic Gulf Stream that transports warm water from the tropical area toward the northwestern part of the Atlantic. And in this way, it gives the heat back to the atmosphere, and it's influencing the climate. It brings a much milder climate.
So it's basically the heat that's getting stored in the tropics.
The heat, yes.
And that's then getting released.
And then it's getting released to the atmosphere, and through atmospheric teleconnection, it impacts the climate of northwestern Europe and other parts of the world.
Right. So in the North Atlantic, this is where the warm water from the Caribbean hits the Arctic. It cools down, and then it sinks. And this ends up slowing down the ocean's circulation. What does a slow circulation mean for climates in Europe and North America?
So what you are describing is just the surface part of what we call Atlantic Meridional Quaternary Circulation. And this will mean a decrease in temperature. If we think in the future that we have quite a strong global warming impacting all the regions of the planet, this will mean that it might be that certain regions will warm a bit less than others. And this might be the case for the northwestern Europe compared to other regions.
And this is basically the whole idea behind the movie The Day After Tomorrow. A warmer ocean tends to slow down circulation in the Atlantic, producing ironically colder temperatures in Europe and North America. I imagine you've got some reservations about the science of that movie, but that's essentially the idea underpinning that, right?
Yeah, the Day After Tomorrow movie is a very extreme. It shows a very extreme situation that we could not for the moment reproduce with our climate models, but indeed if Atlantic Meridional Quaternary Circulation would collapse, this would lead to a strong cooling over large continental areas.
And so what's your view on how much the oceans influence the climate? Could a significant slowdown cancel out the effects of global warming in North America and northwestern Europe?
From the experience that we have with our own climate model and from other studies, we saw that under the global warming conditions over the next 100 years or so, there is a tendency toward a weaker MOC, but by about 30%. And I think this will translate into a reduced warming over the northwestern Europe, reduced warming by, I don't know, half a degree up to 1 degree.
A measurable and significant amount.
A measurable amount, but this I don't think that this will be able to fully counteract the global warming. So we'll still have a warming, but slightly reduced warming.
This winter is mild in Europe, but last winter was particularly cold. Did ocean circulation play a role in this, in your view?
I think that ocean circulation definitely is impacting the average climate, and also it can contribute to the variation, the interannual variation. But the fact that we have for the moment a milder winter in Europe, and we had last year a very cold winter, it's mostly due to the atmospheric variability, to what we call North Atlantic Oscillation, that strongly controls the winter climate in Europe. So this year we have a tendency toward a stronger North Atlantic Oscillation. This will bring this kind of mild winters, a rainy winter, and when this oscillation is in a very weak state, like last year, for example, this will lead to a very cold winter. So, and this atmospheric variability, this mode of variability over the North Atlantic, influences both the climate of Europe and the North Atlantic circulation.
Well, let's turn to your paper now in Science magazine this week. You wanted to investigate the possibility of predicting ocean circulation and its impact on the climate, right?
Right.
And you were looking at one specific location in the Atlantic, latitude 26.5 degrees north.
Right.
Why did you pick this spot?
So we had to pick this latitude because this is the latitude at which We have observations of the strength of the Atlantic meridional watertone circulation. So it's the only latitude where there are measurements that started in 2004 by a British-American project, Rapid MOCA. The measurements are taken there, and they are taken there also because there is a very strong correlation between the ocean circulation and the ocean heat transport in the Atlantic.
So not only is this a particularly important part of the Atlantic where a change occurs with heat being given off, but also you've got the observed data there, and observed data is very important for checking whether your model is correct.
Yes, it's absolutely necessary. Without observations, we can just, guesswork.
And maybe you could explain that briefly. I mean, you check your model's accuracy by doing hindcasts, basically feeding the model data up to a certain point from the past and then seeing if the model can get the subsequent data right. Is that how it works?
Yes, indeed. So when we do this retrospective hindcast or retrospective forecast, so we initialize our model with temperature and salinity, so with ocean observation representative for the respective time, for example, 2004, and we run our model in the future for up to 10 years, and we compare the results of this hindcast with observation. We try to verify our models. Yes, indeed.
And how did your model do at predicting the last decade?
So we saw from our results that we have good skill in predicting the AMOC variations for up to 4 years in advance. And we find that, and since this is the first study of AMOC prediction, we consider results encouraging.
So what does your model say about the next 4 years? Is ocean circulation likely to speed up, slow down, or remain stable?
Our forecasts for the next 10 years are showing that at least till 2014 or so, we'll have a stable MOC, with the exception of a very short decrease in MOC that happened at the beginning of 2010. So we started our forecast in different moments in time, 2010, 2011, and we saw that only for a very short period, due to the atmospheric variability, the MOC has decreased, but after this it has recovered at a very stable levels.
That was Daniela Matai from the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg. Time now for a roundup of some news from the past week. Here's Joanna Impey.
Eco News. Marine scientists have discovered the first known example of hybrid sharks that they say could show how some fish deal with climate change. 57 offspring of two related but distinct species of sharks were found in waters off Australia's eastern coast this week. The smaller Australian blacktip favours tropical waters in the north, while the larger common blacktip prefers more temperate regions. The study's lead researcher, Jess Morgan from the University of Queensland, described the interbreeding as evolution in action. She said the offspring would have the advantage of being able to extend their range in a changing environment. A new census has found that the number of elephants in two wildlife sanctuaries in Tanzania dropped by 42% in 3 years. Wildlife officials blame an increase in poaching for tusks. Tanzania has between 110 and 140,000 elephants, one of the largest concentrations of the animals in the world. The Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, TRAFIC, recently said that large confiscations of tusks made 2011 the worst year for elephants since ivory sales were banned in 1989. Activists said poaching had reached alarming levels in several African countries and that some could lose their elephant populations entirely. BP has expanded its lawsuit against the contractor Halliburton over the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill. The oil giant is now seeking full repayment of all costs and damages related to the disaster, saying that Halliburton botched a cement job meant to seal the Deepwater Horizon well. When that well exploded on April 20, 2010, 11 people were killed. Millions of barrels of oil gushed into the ocean before it was capped 87 days later. The German airline Lufthansa says it will raise ticket prices due to the European Union's emissions trading scheme. The airline became the first major carrier to announce a surcharge in response to the EU rules which came into effect for aviation at the beginning of this year. Since the 1st of January, all airlines that touch down or take off in airports in 30 European countries will have to account for their emissions using the EU's carbon market. The US, China and India have all attacked the rules. They say it infringes on their sovereignty. The EU says it's the fairest way to deal with aviation's contribution to climate change.
That was Joanna Impey with the Environment News. To fair trade now. It's an idea that some say is helping to eradicate injustice. Farm goods from developing countries sold with the fair trade label may be a little bit more expensive, but the people who grow or harvest them get a better deal. In two cooperations with regional broadcasters, we're going to hear from two parts of the world that are trying to put the fair trade idea into practice. First, a fair wine business in South Africa. Holly Fox voices this co-production with Bush Radio Cape Town.
At the Nepegan farm in Stellenbosch, some 50 kilometres east of Cape Town, workers are busy cutting back the grapevines. Charles Wen is in charge of the grape pickers. He's also an agriculture student. A few years ago, that would have been impossible because he worked 12 hours a day processing grapes for Thandi Wine. But in 2003, Thandi became the world's first winery to receive fair trade certification. That changed Wen's life. His employers were obliged to obey new labor rules and regulations. Workers are now entitled to proper contracts, 2 weeks paid holiday a year, and a working week no longer than 48 hours.
Fair trade is also benefit us financially, not in the sense that we have the money in our hands, but we can provide for our children. For example, we have paid all the children's school fees, their school gear, administration fees, everything we have paid in.
Consumers who sip Thandi wine pay an extra fair trade premium of 6 euro cents a bottle. With sales of 600,000 bottles a year, that amounts to a tidy 36,000 euros. The money has to be spent on communal projects. On Nepegan Farm, it pays for school rooms and teaching for the 96 workers and their children. The children's nursery received heating, mattresses, and a refrigerator, and every home on the farm got a satellite dish. Now the workers are saving their money. The government is going to build new housing near the farm, and the future tenants want to add things like tile floors and tankless water heaters.
If they come back from work, they want to stand in the shower with a bit of warm water, especially on harvesting time. When they finish harvesting the grapes, when they come back at night, they are sticky, yeah, with all the grape juice. So we just want to come and stand under the shower with some warm water.
Under apartheid, white people controlled almost all of the country's resources. To compensate for years of discrimination, South Africa has introduced a program to empower blacks economically. Thandi was one of the products of this movement. The workers own half of the farm and a part of the winery business. In good years, the workers receive dividends worth about 100 euros. But these ownership changes don't go far enough, according to Boudewyn Goossens, the director of the Fair Trade Label in South Africa.
How do you expect somebody to participate in farm management if he's living on a shack? How do you expect somebody to be owner of a farm or partly owner of a farm if you can't read and write, doesn't know what kind of contract he's signing? So I think really empowerment starts with the basics, and that's very much what fair trade stands for.
On Bergendal Farm, some 200 workers produce fair trade wine, tea and citrus fruit. They've earned a quarter of a million euros in fair trade premium since 2004. For them, investment in education is also a priority. These young students are learning Afrikaans. The local school buildings have been fixed up with the help of fair trade money, which also encouraged others to step forward with more funds. One of the co-owners of Bergendal Farms is Ronald van Zyl.
Not everything was done with fair trade money. We only built the amphitheater in front. Okay? When we did that, the government decided, well, we'll join in with the computer center and we'll join in with the great art class. And the rest of the farms, the one did this, the one did that. So everything joined in and now we have this. Actually, it's a center of excellence now. Good discipline, good training, good facilities.
Fairtrade may not have all the answers, but it's helping these kids get a better education. Holly Fox, Deutsche Welle Radio.
From fair wine to fair pineapples now. Costa Rica is the world's biggest pineapple exporter. It supplies more than half of global demand every year. Massive companies dominate the trade. Some small Costa Rican farmers have found a niche by promising good working conditions and organic produce. But they don't have it easy. Andreas Ilmer presents this radio collaboration with Costa Rica's Sistema Radiofónico, UCR.
Work begins at 5 in the morning in Orlando Rojas' pineapple fields and stretches into the afternoon. Rojas first began growing pineapples here in Costa Rica 3 years ago, attracted by a burgeoning export market. Rojas sells fair trade fruit and his produce thrives without chemical fertilizers or pesticides.
We decided to go organic to preserve our land and to protect what belongs to us. I have to think about the environment. Our land is my children's future, so how can I poison it? That's why we started with organic. Now we continue step by step. It's slow, but we're moving forward.
Last year, pineapples earned Costa Rica $600 million, but few people reap most of the money. The main beneficiaries are large multinational companies that grow pineapples in monoculture across pieces of land that can stretch up to 4,000 hectares. Small producers like Orlando Rojas, who have farms of 7 hectares at the very most, find it difficult to compete. So Rojas and 5 other pineapple farmers came together to form an agricultural development association for the northern region of Costa Rica called Agro Norte. They realized it would be impossible to compete with the likes of Del Monte, Chiquita and Dole and decided the fair trade label was their only hope. The head of Agro Norte, Royeli Villalobos, worries that small farmers are losing their land.
It's estimated that more than 3,000 hectares of land were lost just in the last year, but it's only the small producers that are losing their land. The massive plantations continue to grow and buy up the other farms. If we allow this to happen, then the day will come when we, my children and the children of my children, will have to work for one of these companies.
Depending on the international market, pineapple prices can vary from 18 to 60 US cents per kilo. Fair trade producers are guaranteed 60 cents per kilo for conventionally grown pineapples and 77 cents per kilo for organic pineapples. With these prices, Yurieli Villalobos can promise the Agro Norte producers a secure livelihood.
Here we're making the difference. We're a group of producers with small businesses. We're creating our own prosperity for our own families. We decided to get certified for fair trade because under conventional conditions, we're not as competitive. The fair trade label opens the door to the market for us.
Es una puerta que el supermercado no sabe.
Through fair trade, the producers earn a price that at the very least covers their production cost. So far, they've used it for their children's schooling and to set up a woman-run small business that makes and sells shampoo. To be considered fair trade, Agro Norte members are required to farm almost entirely without pesticides, to treat men and women equally, and to not use child labor. Andreas Ilmer, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And that's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to leave comments for the show, you can write to us at Living Planet, that's one word, at dw-world.de. Till next week, I'm Nathan Whitcomb. Bye for now.
Yo no quiero un país a la sombra de la vida. Yo no quiero a mi nación en plena luz dormida. No quiero ver a mi tierra rematando su honor en un mercado de esbirros, traficantes de dolor. Yo quiero a mi patria clara, presta al sol de la mañana, que madruga cada día para iniciar la esperanza y en el fondo de la noche divisar mi luna blanca, iluminando el futuro con la luz de tu mirada. Ah, amor, mi vida, yo lo canto al alba y al caer el día, abriendo el futuro, lo levanto entero, con su sangre vivo, por su vida muero. La, la, la.